David Gessner has written a lot of books about our relationship with wild places. His own relationship with the land has been greatly inspired by an old friend, one he's only ever met in books, Theodore Roosevelt, our 26th president. It's as much Roosevelt's actions as his words that Gessner finds motivating, and five words in particular, which were spoken by Roosevelt during an historic journey.
In 1903, Theodore Roosevelt undertook what was really the first campaign tour. And it involved a 14,000-mile train ride across the country. It's where the word whistle-stop tour came from. And one of the climactic moments was when he arrived at the Grand Canyon. He took a horse ride up to the Grand Canyon. What did seeing that sight, the Great Gorge, do to him? What I think it did to him was blow his mind, to put it mildly. And then when he looked over and he saw the bruise-like oranges and purples of that morning, I believe it did something to him. Nature always did something to him, and that was one of the best things about it. So when he came back later that afternoon to deliver his speech, he put into words how we had to preserve nature, not just for ourselves, but for those beyond us. This was a place to leave as it was.
In the Grand Canyon, Arizona has a natural wonder, which, so far as I know, is in kind absolutely unparalleled throughout the rest of the world. I want to ask you to do one thing in connection with it, in your own interest, and in the interest of the country, to keep this great wonder of nature as it now is. Leave it as it is.
That speech is the environmental equivalent of the Gettysburg Address. It's so stirring. And these were the words Roosevelt fired in the first shot of what was to become a century-long environmental battle.
You cannot improve on it. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it. What you can do is keep it for your children. Your children's children, and for all who come after you, as one of the great sights which every American, if he can travel at all, should see.
When Roosevelt delivered the speech, he was talking to locals who were invested in not leaving the canyon as it was. He was lucky that day in that several Rough Riders from his regiment in Cuba were there, and they'd been drinking since morning. So he had not only a supportive crowd, but some rowdy local cowboys rooting him on, which, as any environmentalist knows, can be very helpful when wading into enemy territory.
We have gotten past the stage, my fellow citizens, where we are to be pardoned if we treat any part of our country as something to be skinned for 2 or 3 years for the use of the present generation, whether it is the forest, the water, the scenery. Whatever it is, handle it so that your children's children will get the benefit of it.
He delivered the speech and ended emphatically with those words that we are still saying today. Leave it as it is. Without Roosevelt having done what he did during his time 120 years ago, we wouldn't have 230 million acres of public land. His was a powerful story about place, and I feel like it's our responsibility now to revise that story and make it fit our times and become more expansive and inclusive, but still work with the root and the basics of the story of leaving it as it is.
Those five words, leave it as it is, have served as a rallying cry for environmentalists and those passionate about public lands ever since Theodore Roosevelt spoke them more than a century ago at the edge of the Grand Canyon. But simple and romantic as the phrase may at first sound, it turns out to be much more complicated, about as complicated as the man who spoke them. I'm Benjamin Bombard, sitting in for Doug Fabrizio. This is Radio West. Today on the program, we're talking about Teddy Roosevelt's legacy as a conservationist, how his vision has evolved, and what it may still have to teach us, even as the times and the culture have radically changed since his day. Our guest is the nature writer David Gessner. His new book is called Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's Wilderness. Like Roosevelt, Gessner grew up out east. And again, like Roosevelt, and like so many others, Gessner found himself out west.
I had found myself mired at the age of 29 in my hometown of Worcester, Massachusetts. And during that year, I discovered I had testicular cancer and wrote my journal at one point, I don't know what's worse, cancer or Worcester, but we'll leave that as it is. And while I was recovering in May, when I just turned 30, I got the results back from the applications I'd made to creative writing programs. And I opened them one by one and got rejected one by one. Hmm. And the last note I got was from Boulder, Colorado, where I'd been accepted at CU. And I always say that was the deus ex machina of my life. That was the moment I was airlifted from Worcester to Boulder. So I drove pretty much straight through. I might have been sipping on some Budweisers at one point. And when I saw the Rockies, it was like the cliche, you know, all I needed was John Denver to come on the radio. Mm. And that period, that fall, when I lived in the little town of El Dorado Springs, south of Boulder, was a period of starting to get back in physical shape, into hiking. I happened to run into this mentor, Oak Thorne, called himself, who taught me the names of the trees and the birds and the rocks. And it was just this really primal kind of comeback for me into health. And not long after, there was a literary kind of equivalent of that. I had already been reading Ed Abbey, but I started to read Wallace Stegner and started to learn about the place more. So for me, there was a real exhilaration. And of course, Stegner's famous line of the geography of hope, for me, it was quite literal that it was a place of hope. And for me, it was just, I thought I was getting old and my life was set in one way and it broke life open. And I think that's true of me, but it's also an archetypal kind of American trope, right, of the Easterner coming west. And we certainly see it with Teddy.
Yeah, talk about Teddy. What was your relationship? Did you have a relationship with Teddy Roosevelt, such as it could be, spanning, 100 plus years before you came west? And what did you find in Teddy Roosevelt?
Well, my early relationship with Roosevelt was similar probably to a lot of modern readers, which was there was a period in the very late 70s, early 80s, where two great biographies came out, the Edmund Morris biography and the David McCullough Mornings on Horseback. What I remembered most from those books, which I had read before I came west, but I reread once I got west, was that key moment where Roosevelt, at the tender age of 24, witnesses the death of his wife and mother within a 24-hour period and leaves New York behind and heads out to the Badlands. And talk about, mine was a relatively minor reawakening compared to what he went through, right? It's like he suddenly is in the saddle 24 hours a day as a rancher. Mm-hmm. He's out in wilderness hunting alone. There's this kind of breaking down of his previous life. He said, "It is here that the romance of my life began." But it was romance, but it was also melded, of course, with kind of a depression about what had happened to him, which was so horrible. And his reaction to that depression, he said, "Black care seldom stays behind a rider who travels fast," right? His reaction was kind of hyperactive activity as a sort of exorcism, of what he'd left behind and an embracing of the wilderness that he found there.
Can you talk a little bit more about what Teddy Roosevelt was like and kind of what his early life was like. He grew up a rather sickly boy and he wasn't that man that was kind of big and brash. He had this big, big personality, but that wasn't the first Teddy.
You know, later his daughter Alice would say he wanted to be the corpse at every funeral, the bride at every wedding, the baby at every christening. Even as a kid, he was a storytelling lover of attention within his family, but he was small and sickly and asthmatic. In the spirit of the time, his father, who he worshipped, would take him out on coach rides to try to help him breathe. But his father says to him at one point, "You have the mind, but you don't have the body. You must make your body." And at that point, you know, you almost see the montage from an upper crust Rocky film playing, where this little, you know, Manhattanite, rich, somewhat spoiled, scrawny child starts to work out. And the myth is this happens, you know, in the montage scene. The truth is it takes years for the development. But what he does sort of realize is he will not back down to anyone. His courage is a consistent theme in Roosevelt's life, and he is courageous. He's a creature of action and decisiveness, and also a creature of words. When he's doing these adventures, when he's going down the Amazon or he's going to Africa, when he's doing adventures even as a young man, he's also writing about them.
Well, you write in your book that this isn't a biography of Teddy Roosevelt. That's been done elsewhere, and it's been done really well, as you've already mentioned. But it does read, I must say, as in parts like the biography of a love affair, how an upper crust Easterner, the scion of a well-to-do family, you said a scrawny kind of pipsqueak when he was a kid, fell in love with nature, remade himself. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think it's so important to remember that this guy who becomes known as, you know, this bellicose figure really wanted not to be a soldier or a statesman, but a naturalist like his hero Charles Darwin when he was young. And he really learns the science of the thing. He's studying animals. Later, when he starts to go into wilderness, he knows the names of things. He's frustrated with John Muir that he doesn't know the names of birds. So there's that transformation too. He's such a complicated figure, and I go into his flaws quite a bit in the book. Mm-hmm. I talk about his prejudices. Well, his greatest prejudice that he overcame that many of us don't was anthropomorphism, where he saw beyond the human world. And this is partly due to his early training. It's partly because he was just one of those people who was, when he was out in nature, a chord was struck in him. And he expanded.
So you say that in recent years, you'd be giving a lot of thought to what you call in the book, and this old lesson that no matter how often public lands are quote unquote saved, they're never really safe. And of course, the Trump administration has been rolling back environmental protections. States like Utah have been engaged in this ongoing battle to seize public lands. And thinking about all that, it seems, made you ask this question, what would Teddy do? And you came up with a list of things that Teddy would do. And can you read the list for us, what Teddy would do?
So I was thinking about what Roosevelt would do, and I knew he'd fight like hell to preserve the land. But I wondered what else, so I jotted down a quick list in my journal, and here's the list. Get into the wild, study birds, drink lots of coffee, which he did from dawn till dusk, get into spirited battles, speak his mind, read and learn about threatened places, write about those places, get in fighting trim, and offend some people, which he was always quite good at, by the way. And for me, I had a use for Roosevelt. I was kind of calling myself out. I said, look, you've written 10 books about the environment. Maybe it's time to stop just writing sentences and do some fighting and offend some people. So it's like Teddy was grabbing me by the lapels and saying, come on, buck up. It's time to cause a little trouble.
So, and then this project was born for you on October 27th, 2017. And that date is important for a couple reasons, some really important for especially your project. Will you lay out what happened that day and the project that comes to mind that ends up becoming this book?
October 27th, 2017 was Theodore Roosevelt's birthday. I believe at the time he would have been 159. It was also the day that Ryan Zinke, then Secretary of the Interior, undeclared 85% of Bears Ears National Monument and undeclared significant amounts of Grand Staircase Escalante as well. And he did this standing in front of a portrait of Roosevelt while claiming he was a proud Roosevelt Republican. So the utter hypocrisy of that moment was a strong motivating factor in the book.
And so the Antiquities Act, it should be pointed out, was used by President Obama, as you said, to declare the Bears Ears. And it's been used to declare 160 other national monuments as well, other than Bears Ears. But Bears Ears, in your conception, I'd like you to lay this out for us quickly. It's different. It's distinctive. Why is Bears Ears different, and why is this distinction important to you?
Well, the distinction is it's the first national monument that grew out of the thinking and planning and efforts of Native American tribes, the Bears Ears Intertribal Council. And why that is so important is so much of our saved land in the past was the ripping away of Native land. And so here we have Roosevelt's act that was his superpower. I say, like, Thor had his hammer, Captain America had his shield, Roosevelt had the Antiquities Act. And it's the misconception that he created it. It was created by Congress in 1906, but he sure as hell knew what to do with it. He went and saved lands one after another. But it's interesting, the very first one he saved was Devil's Tower, famous for Close Encounters. And
a sacred Native American site.
Bears Ears was, you know, the most recent of Bears Lodge was the first, and it was taken away. You know, it was a sacred Native American site. Mm. So what we have going on differently here is it's almost a confluence of America's idea of parks and monuments with Native ideals. And that really comes to fruition, or that comes together, flows together in Bears Ears. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't necessarily know this when Zinke undeclared the land, but at that moment I said, I'm getting out there. And in January of 2018, I headed to Utah, actually. I flew into Salt Lake City. Mm. And I was lucky to get some very good advice early on to seek out people who had been on the Intertribal Council. And the first person I interviewed was probably the most important person I interviewed the whole time, Regina Lopez White Skunk, Ute Mountain Ute, a representative on the Tribal Council. One of the first things I said was, I have a neighbor back home who says this isn't the right use for the Antiquities Act, back home being North Carolina. And she said, I'd like to talk to that neighbor. We spent a week studying the act and decided consciously how we were going to use it and use it as it was meant to be used. She also said we weren't trying to settle old scores. We didn't want to say we want our land back. We were trying to find a creative new use for a tool that had been often used against us, and now we were going to use it for us. Mm-hmm. Really, from that first interview, I kind of had the vision that I'd been given, gifted by Regina, and I started to see that everywhere, and it really made for a deeper experience, an experience where I had to call out Roosevelt. Mm. Of course, his attitude toward Native Americans was indefensible, and so I don't try to defend it.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get to that a little bit later in the conversation. And so your visit to Utah, which you've just described, and your conversations with Regina Lopez White Skunk, among others, it gives you an idea for this project, and it's a kind of a journey in the wake of Theodore Roosevelt. What's the idea?
Well, while I was out there, I'd already sent a book proposal out. And I got the phone call. The book had sold on the Glen Canyon Dam. And the last day on this scouting mission that I'd gone out and talked to Regina, I climbed to the base of Bears Ears with a friend, Greg Lehman, who's a Navajo rafting guide. So when I got back home, I'd been thinking about how I was going to pull this book off, and I decided what better than a road trip back to Bears Ears, a long road trip back to Bears Ears, following roughly the trip that Roosevelt took in 1903, but touching on all the spots that were so important to Roosevelt. And as coincidence would have it, my nephew Noah, 21-year-old, was just graduating from college in North Carolina. And I said, hey, you want a graduation present? And I picked him up in June. We drove up the Eastern Seaboard, where a former college classmate of mine, Jamie Raskin, was a congressman, and we got to walk into the offices of Congress. And then we headed up to Roosevelt's house, Sagamore Hill in Long Island. And Noah didn't like it because it was so dark and full of dead animals. And then we headed to Harvard, where Roosevelt had spent those formative years. And then from there, we headed west. And Noah was deathly bored throughout the Midwest. And, you know, I asked him what he thought of Teddy. He wasn't too positive. He hated, you know, I was listening to books on tape along the way and some of Roosevelt's speeches. And Noah got quite sick of phrases like manly vigor. But Noah opened up when we finally got to the Midwest and headed into the Badlands and saw buffalo and were suddenly camping out in the wild. And so the idea was to follow Roosevelt's trip and wend our way back to Bear's Ears.
David Gessner. His new book is called Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's Wilderness. We'll take a break, back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Station Insider is KUER's weekly email digest. We'll bring you the most important news stories of the week, information about online events and services during the coronavirus situation, and of course, sneak peeks at what's happening at the station. Check out our other regular dispatches too, including the Radio West newsletter. To sign up for these weekly updates, just go to KUER.org/newsletters.
This is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard, sitting in for Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about Theodore Roosevelt's environmental legacy and what it has to teach us today, how it can be reimagined to fit the challenges facing public lands right now. Our guest is the nature writer David Gessner, and as he writes in his latest book, Roosevelt's presidency was the first and only time in our country's history when wildness and wilderness were truly national priorities. In an effort to better understand Roosevelt's impact on the country, David Gessner undertook a cross-country journey in the footsteps of TR. That's the subject of his new book. It's called Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's Wilderness. On his trip, Gessner and his traveling companion Noah, his nephew, stopped in North Dakota in the town of Medora. That's where Roosevelt owned and worked on a pair of cattle ranches in his mid-20s. These days, Gessner writes, Medora is a kind of Disneyland with Roosevelt as its Mickey Mouse.
It's a kind of Teddy Roosevelt theme park to some degree. On our way to our campsite, I saw a building with Roosevelt's signature on the side, and I thought, oh, it's a museum. We'll pull in here. But it turned out to be more of an employment center for the residents of this Disneyland of Teddy. And so Noah and I went to use the bathroom, and on the way to the bathroom, we ran into Teddy Roosevelt himself, and we started talking to him, and lo and behold, I'm currently doing talks, Zoom talks around the country with that Teddy impersonator, Larry Marple, who's a real character and portrays a real character.
And we should say that Larry Marple is the voice that you heard at the beginning of the show who played Teddy Roosevelt on our show. What did the West mean to Roosevelt? And what did wilderness mean when he came out here? A kid from Long Island.
Well, when he came out in the wake of the death of his wife and daughter to work on the ranch, he threw himself into the work and felt like this was an escape from the kind of echo chamber of the political world of the East. But he also went on these long hunting trips and kind of tested himself. And of course, that's something Wallace Stegner always said, that many people regarded the West as a great testing ground itself. These vast spaces, the extreme weather, the extreme, solitude and isolation. And Roosevelt threw himself into this. And there was an aspect, a very masculine aspect for him of proving himself, as if his dad, who had passed away by then, was still alive, kind of looking down on him. So there was a macho element. But what I'm really interested in is this other element where I really believe that this person, who in some ways was so egocentric, actually has some borders with our current president in terms of his blustering manner, also could find when he was alone, when he was out in the natural world, when he was looking down at the Little Missouri, when he was listening to the, you know, the shimmer of the cottonwoods, could get beyond that bluster and that ego and get outside of himself into the world.
So Roosevelt left Medora and the West after just a year, and after a particularly harsh winter. And you're right that in some ways he'd come out West too late. It was already too late, and he soon realized this. What do you mean by that?
Well, by the time he came, he had a hard time hunting the buffalo he wanted to find. The realm of the great shaggy beasts of buffalo had become the realm of cows. Clearly, he was partly responsible for that as a rancher and as a hunter. But his hunting amounted to the kind of small change compared to the massive slaughter of the buffalo. And he would continue to push further west to wilder places because this place had already been, in his mind, domesticated. This is the winter of 86-87, this devastating blizzard. The winter of the blue snow comes in and kills much of his stock. And he does leave the West behind as a rancher. He never leaves it behind in his heart, and he continuously gets out there, even while he's president. And, you know, he'll go on camping trips, famously with John Muir, and John Burroughs in Yellowstone. In fact, that was the next step of his whistle stop tour after Medora, and of my trip too, which is we went to Yellowstone and we, you know, kind of followed in Roosevelt's footsteps. And before we leave Medora, I got to squeeze one last thing in because it embodies Roosevelt to me, which is when he's at one point when he's at his ranch, these boat thieves steal this boat of his, start heading up the Little Missouri, and it's the dead of winter, and ice blocks are chock full in the Little Missouri, and he and his two ranch hands build a boat to go chasing after the boat thief. But before he gets in the boat, he grabs Anna Karenina. Between hunting down the thieves, he reads, you know, Tolstoy.
So, as you were saying before, you left North Dakota, and you headed on to Yellowstone, the world's first national park, and where you begin this book is on the edge of the Grand Canyon, where Roosevelt delivers this real gem of a line, leave it as it is. And on the northern entrance of Yellowstone, there's this arch with more words of note from Roosevelt. It says, for the benefit and enjoyment of the people. Why were you in Yellowstone? And that phrase there is complicated, right, when you think about Yellowstone, yeah, for the benefit and enjoyment of the people. Can you unpack that a bit for us?
And that phrase is so linked, not just because Roosevelt said it, but to kind of his idea of, you know, conservation versus preservation. And it's linked to this idea of parks as our playground. Mm-hmm. And certainly he used the wilderness as playground, too. And we got the worst of it when Noah and I were going through in one of those bison traffic jams, you know, waiting for an hour, crawling through with the millions of other people. Noah and I saw a couple of grizzlies. You know, that, of course, in itself was exciting, but we had to fight through other hordes of tourists to see this. So I feel like that phrase, in a way, has backfired. But I also know that Roosevelt meant that. But he also had a secret agenda. He wanted the big carnivores, the big animals, the big ecosystems to stay intact, as well as giving us our enjoyment. Mm. And the truth is, at Yellowstone, what you have, it's only like 2% of the park that we're seeing us humans crowd. You've got 98% where you now have grizzly bears, mountain lions, wolves. You have that wilderness still, and that's the result of that attempt to preserve. That's the better part of the park for me.
When you write in that thinking about wilderness, as we do as this place without people, this is an interesting idea that we may be playing into a kind of willful amnesia. Can you talk about that?
Well, of course, there was a time when this wilderness had no people, but it wasn't the 1600s. We've now doubled. In just recent months, we've doubled the amount of time that humans occupied this continent. Mm. So these were hunting grounds. These were homes. This was territory.
You're talking about national parks across the country.
Yeah, where Native people lived here. So our idea of uninhabited nature, pristine nature, has rightly been criticized lately, that we wanted this kind of sense of no one there, when there, if not always been there, there have long been people there. And so when we're criticizing John Muir and Roosevelt for America's best idea, we're criticizing them because they're trying to kind of recreate an is that wasn't, right? Leave it as it is. Well, that's not how it was. That's leave it how we'd like to think it was. That being said, I try to balance that with the fact that the alternative to that wouldn't have been like a pastoral native paradise. It would have probably been shopping malls, or it would have been private land. Americans at the time and earlier were crawling across the country like a pack of locusts and devouring what was in front of them. And so the parks were a break to that. Certainly there are instances where native land was just usurped for parks. But there are also plenty of times where those two things weren't concurrent. You know, it was already out of the hands of the indigenous people, and it was not taking it away from native people, but it was saving it from being despoiled by us, by the European conquerors. So it's a messier situation than either side presents it to be. And there's still a lot of good in having preserved those parks, but we have to recognize the bloody history that is part of the park and monument history too.
Yeah, you're right that reservation, that word reservation, it was the general name for both the places that the country wanted to put Indians and the forest preserves and other quote-unquote saved lands that were being set aside. So that kind of catches that dichotomy a bit there.
Right. It's, you know, it's almost like here's our nature park and here's our Indian park. And we're going to treat the nature park a lot nicer than we are the native park.
And this kind of gets us in a way to this current moment. Roosevelt's statue outside the American Museum of Natural History, of course, has been taken down. A victim of, some would say, so-called cancel culture. He was a great and inspiring naturalist, a true environmentalist, but he could also be jingoistic, you say, a chest-beating America firster. And, of course, we've talked about this fact that, you know, his support for the national parks and national monuments caused Native Americans to be shunted off their land. How are you thinking about that Roosevelt, the one that it feels contentious right now? It was kind of, your book came out just at the same moment that his statue was taken down. What did you think about that? How are you thinking about that debate right now?
You know, he always wanted to be in the news, and it's shocking how much he's in the news right now with the book coming out. From
he'd
Trump saying Yosemite to, you know, Mount Rushmore, and of course to the statue. And I feel like he would have supported taking the statue down. If he lived now, I mean, that's a simple test of empathy we seem to have forgotten. How would we have done then, and how would they do now? Mm. And Roosevelt, whose racial theories were one of the worst things about him, even though they did not come out in practice in terms of inviting Booker Washington to the White House in terms of his progressive views, you know, I say that by the last time he ran for president, he had a platform that would have made Bernie blush. Mm. He was just, you know, Bull Moose was ahead on everything, including we're right now celebrating women's right to vote. He was one of the early proponents of that, too. So when people just say to me, oh, he's a racist, sexist pig, I'm saying, well, that's part of the story. So I think he would have supported having that particular statue come down. I support having it come down because it's offensive and kind of presents the worst of Roosevelt. But you've got to remember that at the same time, the Museum of Natural History is changing its Hall of Biodiversity name to Theodore Roosevelt Hall. So they're celebrating the best of him, as well as taking away the worst, the best being having saved that 230 million acres. I think the thing to also remember about Roosevelt, he was, in the words of Wallace Stegner, a grower. His sense of empathy expanded, as did his policies. He was an egocentric talker who could monologue on forever, but also a great listener who had very many close friends, including close women friends, throughout his life. So, you know, I understand and believe in calling out people's bad behavior. I also said in a recent essay, you know, we don't expect people before Newton to discuss gravity. We have to go back to a little bit giving people the slack of their time. Where Roosevelt's ahead of his time environmentally, I praise him, where he's behind it. For instance, Manifest Destiny was already a half century old when Roosevelt was in power, and he's still clinging to Manifest Destiny-like ideas. He needs to be given some crap for that. It's true. But he also needs to be praised where he pushed things ahead with social programs that would eventually lead to his distant cousin, Franklin's New Deal. So, I mean, it's a complicated thing. It's a little bit of a mess. And I just want to add that as far as how I approach figures from the past, I had a great Professor Walter Jackson Bate, a great biographer of Samuel Johnson and John Keats, who talked about how we go to biography selfishly. We look for what we can use in our own lives. So when I go back to figures of the past, I'm fine with calling out what's bad, but that's not what I'm there to find. If they did great things and had, I want to know, how did they do that? How did this person live? What can I steal for my own life? And that's a very different way to look at past figures than scolding them.
The Nature writer David Gessner. His new book is called Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's Wilderness. We'll take another break and be back in a minute. You're listening to Radio West.
Independent public service journalism has never been more important than it is right now. KUER helps you make sense of the world, including the world of politics. Even as we're covering the coronavirus situation, our newsroom is also closely watching the races around Utah, like the race for governor. Local politics has a big impact on our everyday lives, and listener support keeps our reporting strong. Make a big impact in your community. Show your support at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard, sitting in for Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the Nature writer David Gessner. We're talking about his new book, Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's Wilderness. From Yellowstone, you and Noah headed farther west, California, Yosemite National Park, and the coast, which was Noah's goal. And his goal was to travel coast to coast across America as part of your graduation present to him. But the journey wasn't over for you. Noah headed home. This book, at all times, it really feels like it's headed towards this confrontation over Bears Ears National Monument, which we talked a bit about earlier, or what remains of it, of course, since President Trump shrunk it in 2017 to 85% its original size. If I'm reading it correctly, David, you see in Bears Ears and its creation a kind of redemption of this inclination to protect the land, the conservation ethic that inspired Theodore Roosevelt to set aside wilderness, to leave it as it is, and kind of a redemption in a way of that original sin of pushing a native people off their land that America perpetrated.
I think that's fair to say. First, I'm going to say that for Noah, the trip was pretty much over when I gave him edibles in California.
And different kind of trip.
Home soon after that. But then I headed into back to Bears Ears, and have a long index at the back of the book. And one of the things in there is the Declaration of Bears Ears, which I say reads more like a prose poem than an official government document. It describes the history both before people and with people of this land. It describes phenology, which means the phenomenon of the year and when things grow and bud. It describes the plant life, the geology. And it really, to me, speaks to this idea of deep knowledge of place that is so thrilling. Taurus, of which I've been one many times, by definition can't know a place deeply. What's different about what's in this document than our usual notion of a national park or national monument? Well, use of the place. People using parks not just as a place to take selfies, but as a place to learn about the plant life. And this is all very idealistic. you have to work with reality too. I mean, that's one of the things I really liked about Roosevelt. He talked about walking a ridge, metaphoric ridge, between the kind of elite criminal class, read Trump, the corrupt, evil side of things, and the way too idealistic, impractical side. Mm. And so, but by saving it, by saving it and allowing us to appreciate that this was land that wasn't empty land. It wasn't the land we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. but it was land where people had lived and interacted and had a history for thousands of years is a better way to look at that is that we want to leave it as it is. It's a deeper way. It's a more inclusive way. So my hope is, as I said before, we can take the best of the park ideal and integrate it with this. And what better place than that? Of course, it's not perfect. You know, perfect would have been, first of all, perfect would have been Trump not reducing it, but it also would have been the tribes being given more an authoritative role in Bears Ears also.
I must say that reading your account of the battle for Bears Ears and what's there, thousands, hundreds of thousands by some accounts of ancient sites, it seems to fit rather well under the umbrella of the Antiquities Act, which was designed and written to protect objects of historic and scientific interest. It seems like those are very much there based on your telling of it. But I want to, you mentioned listening earlier and Roosevelt's ability to listen, though he was very interested in himself. He had this unique ability to pay attention and become immersed and to really hear others. And while you were in San Juan County, in the towns of Bluff and Blanding and trekking through Bears Ears, reporting for this book, you heard two opposing narratives and you present them in your book. And I'd like you to set these up for us. One narrative was told by Native American and Anglo advocates for preserving the land, conserving Bears Ears as a monument. And among those you talked to, you mentioned her earlier, was Regina Lopez White Skunk, a member of the Ute Mountain Ute tribe. So tell us a bit about these two narratives that you were hearing.
So in the summer of 2018, when I visited the celebration of Bears Ears in the year after it had been reduced, up in the Bears Ears meadow below the two Bears Ears, there was a sense of being embattled, not just because the land had been reduced, but because local ranchers had moved the signs to us coming in and we'd been buzzed by planes. But there was also a really feeling of solidarity. As Regina Lopez White Skunk said, we've done this before. We've had land taken away before, and we're still going to fight for this place. Mm. And I got to talk to a series of elders, Mark Maryboy, Kenneth Maryboy, Willie Gray Eyes. And so it was great to hear this kind of story being told in the face of opposition. The story being, this is still our place. This fight is not over. It was just inspiring to hear.
And we want to be part of the process.
And we want to be part of the process. And you can be part of the process too. And that was one of the, you know, there wasn't an us against them feel. There was an us against them in terms of those taking, wanting to take the land away.
Mm-hmm. And this other side of the narrative that you depict in your book is, you get it from Phil Lyman. At the time, I believe when you were speaking with him, he was a councilman of San Juan County. Now he's a state representative, Phil Lyman. His story about Bears Ears, and it's one, I got to say, you hear a lot around here. It's about government overreach, the imposed will of a federal government on local land. Tell us about your conversation with Phil Lyman.
You know, those tropes of government overreach are not just local, but they've been adopted by Trump and have been actually part of the history of the Antiquities Act, this kind of push and pull. In fact, during my research talking to Stephen Trimble, it seems like Grand Staircase is an even better example of the howls, the deafening howls of, you know, government overreach, this isn't right, and then communities adapting, and now communities saying, wow, this actually works pretty well to have a town on the edge of a national monument. There's great economic and other benefits to it. So I came in to talk to Phil Lyman, who did tell a different story. And, you know, I think I made a joke early on, you know, I'm this environmentalist, so clearly I'm going to be here to club you. But at first, I really found him to be quite reasonable. I And this was a pleasant surprise. And he also talked about his appreciation of the Navajo and Native culture and, you know, told a different story, as you say, of our efforts to come together, his efforts to come together with the tribes. And the bad guy here was more the elite environmental groups who wanted too much. But what happened during that conversation, which was kind of fascinating, was slowly he started to use these metaphors of being oppressed and even being assaulted by the government. And they actually became somewhat sexual in terms of, you know, I quote them in the book. And the basic distilled line was, we've been screwed. And it's just so funny that that narrative is told so prominently when on the other side you have a historic group, Native people, who so clearly have been screwed. So they're telling this, there's a similar narrative there. On the other hand, what I really do believe is that the other side, the Lyman side, love the land. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and I think that's what's so fascinating here is one of the only common grounds, we just saw it with the Great American Outdoors Act, we saw it during Roosevelt's time, of conservative and liberal, one of the only overlapping things. And historically, public lands have served this purpose, even in the wake of the Civil War, is they unify different sides and different parties and different factions, that there is a common love of the land. Now, how to administer it, what to call it, do we call it a national monument, do we call it this, that's all up for grabs. But there is a communal and group respect. And I think that's exemplified for me in the Bears Ears Meadow itself, which was a meeting ground for tribes thousands of years ago.
So Theodore Roosevelt, of course, declined to run second full term as president. He later ran, as you mentioned, as presidential candidate for the Bull Moose Party, finished second to Democrat Woodrow Wilson, actually beat his handpicked Republican successor, William Howard Taft, whose administration Theodore Roosevelt was deeply disappointed in. After a fateful journey to Africa in 1912, he suffered a series of illnesses that took a heavy toll on him. He lost his son in the First World War, died at his home in Long Island in 1919, aged just 61 years old, a vigorous man, dead at 61. As you write, his legacy, though, is, and you mentioned this earlier, his legacy is very much alive.
Well, it's amazing how relevant Roosevelt remains. Elizabeth Warren, when asked who she wanted to be her running mate, said Teddy because he was brave. You have, on the other hand, people like Nixon has a soft spot in his heart and quotes Roosevelt as he's leaving office for that helicopter. I just said that the land is a common ground. Roosevelt has been a common ground for many different persuasions of politicians throughout the years. Often, if you ask people who their greatest president is, they'll say Lincoln. And if you ask who their favorite is, they'll say Roosevelt. And clearly, you know, Trump just said, what was that line? It was like, I'm almost as good or equal to, because of his signing up the Great American Outdoors Act. I think Teddy would take grave offense at that, and particularly at his next act, which was to assault the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, to which Roosevelt would say, leave it as it is. So he continues to be relevant. He's also newly relevant in a different way. He's a target of kind of the most woke of us, the woke culture, as is his buddy John Muir. And I've said all along, let's call them out where they're wrong, but let's not take down these complex figures. Let's take what's good from them and call out the bad.
I wonder, finally, David Gessner, having immersed yourself in Theodore Roosevelt for so long and thinking about him and his legacy, what would he say about our relationship with the land? And if, maybe I'll put it this way, if you were standing at the edge of the chasm of the great yawning abyss below us right now that we face of in climate change and myriad issues across the landscape, what would he do? What would he say?
Well, I think he would take that basic story, and I hope he would revise it in the more open and inclusive ways we've talked about. But importantly, this fighter was not only not afraid of taking on the moneyed interests. For instance, he took on the trusts and the railroads and tried to break open monopolies. He would have no fear of taking on the fossil fuel industry. He would have no fear of calling out those he liked to call the criminal elite. And so I could see him taking this really difficult issue to rally people to. Climate is different. You know, climate isn't this developer is destroying this land that you like. Climate is more vague, but he had the ability to articulate, even before we knew it, what we wanted, what we hoped for. And I think in the same way he used the children's children's children trope back at the Grand Canyon, I think he could articulate and for us why we need to fight for sustainable life on Earth, but also why we need to fight our own worst habits, our own most consumer-based, rapacious habits. You know, we need to leave it as it is. That applies also to, say, bats with the coronavirus. We need to leave ourselves as we are. We need to still ourselves in ways that we might not be able to do. But it doesn't hurt to have a fighter in the mix, a fighter who's also a wordsmith who can help kind of try to inspire you.
David Gessner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Gessner, he's the author of 10 books. His latest is called Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's Wilderness. Radio West is a production of KUER. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Our thanks to Larry Marple. He played Teddy Roosevelt at the beginning of the show. The program is produced by Tim Slover and myself. Christy Miners is our executive producer. Doug Fabrizio is our host. I'm Benjamin Bombard.